Eileen Dunn, good morning.
Good morning.
I think you surprised everyone last week when you casually announced at the end of a bulletin that you were retiring from reading the news just like that.
Just like that.
Over.
Yeah. Well, I wanted it because I had to get through the bloody thing. So I was trying to, keep a lid on it. Because judging by, and I have to say, I've been absolutely overwhelmed by the reaction, and I'm still dealing with texts and emails. I haven't even got near letters or cards. So people bear with me. I will get back to you. But if that had started in the run up, if people knew, I just would have been struggling. So I had them all tormented. You're not to tell anybody. Deirdre McCarthy said last Friday night, you're the first person who managed to get the newsroom to keep a secret, because it really didn't. I texted a couple of people on Friday afternoon, and one friend of mine said he was trawling all over the internet. He couldn't find anything about it. So it didn't get out really much beyond these walls.
So you got the scoop on your own story.
I got the scoop on my own story. Yeah.
So were you your traditional kind of cool self doing it and everything? Were you feeling emotional?
Maybe towards the very end. If I had to go much longer, I probably might have got wobbly. Beginning to go at the very end. But
when did you decide?
I decided. Well, I'll be 65 next year, but my 40 years are up. So I'm permanent and pensionable. I'm one of the lucky few that walks out of here with my little pension. So that was up this month. So I just decided.
Yeah.
Out of here.
How does it feel now?
Good so far. I mean, I haven't had time to draw a breath. Yeah. I'm looking forward to maybe just get the head down for a couple of days next week. But yeah, good so far. Yeah. I mean, I know like some of the colleagues had to go at 65 and didn't want to go. I'm ready. And I almost went a few years ago and I didn't want to go then when I put my own back against the wall. I wasn't ready. And I'm glad I stayed, and I'm glad I worked through COVID and all of that. But now I'm ready.
Why do you think that? Why are you ready?
Well, I think COVID taught me that too, that actually spending time on your own and doing other things, and that there's more to life. And I'm also looking at some friends who we've lost or who are ill. So I want to just get out and travel a bit and go to the theatre and go to the concert hall. I told Deirdre O'Kelly, she asked me the other night, would I go to the Abbey with her next week? I said, yeah, I promise you, I'll never say again, sorry, I can't, I'm working,
I gathered that you had to be escorted into the building today. Your pass doesn't work anymore.
I had to use the security code, which I never knew. Michelle said to me the other day, and the security code is such and such, as you know. And I said, no, why would I know? I never had to use it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're stuck. And in fact, my exit date was Sunday, which was lucky. So I had Saturday and Sunday. I came over on Sunday and gathered all my bits and pieces. Because normally it would go on the Friday night. But you're gone. I've no email account. I can't use my pass. Gone.
Is it a bit stark?
That's
a bit stark coming in here as a stranger
it
today
is,
kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
It's funny about all that reaction from people and everything. The way they talk these days about people are in parasocial relationships with well-known people, and that they feel they know them. Even though you kind of made yourself quite unknowable in recent years, which you probably have to do as a newsreader, there's some connection there that people have with newsreaders, is there?
There is, yeah. I think familiarity, it's the and I don't know that it'll be like that going forward, because people are not watching the news every night in the way the younger people especially, but in the way that they used to. So, I'm getting stuff from people saying, you've been in my living room every night for the last 40 years. That's not going to happen again, A, because nobody's going to stick at it for 40 years, and B, because people are not watching at the same level. But then there's been a lot of we went as a family. We went to the Trocadero on Friday night when we left here. But then on Saturday, we had the official do on Thursday. So my voice is still a bit ropey after that. But on Saturday night, we went across to our local, which is Harry Burns in Clontarf. We had a cousin home from America and we were meeting up with him. And there were drinks on the house and strangers were sending over drinks. And then a lot of young people came in and said, we grew up watching you with our mothers and fathers,
It's
really been lovely.
And you thanked people particularly for their support during COVID. What was it about that few years? It changed something in you, did it?
It changed something in all of us, I think. But I think when I would go down to the supermarket, remember we were going for our weekly shop?
Yeah.
And you'd go into the supermarket and people would just come to me because they weren't talking to anybody else outside their own house. What's it like? You know, have you to do your own makeup? What do you do? How do you get in? How do you? And even in those early days, I couldn't tell them because every time we came in here, the protocols had changed. You know, so it was just a scary time for everybody. And there was a real sense. Nolan's, I remember saying to one of the managers in Nolan's, they did a great job. They had just done a big construction job. So they were able to facilitate one entrance, one exit and, you know, right of way, up, down. And they really looked after
this is your
well.
Supermarket.
The supermarket, the older people especially. And one of them said to me one day, well done you. And I said, well done you, the way you're running this, you know. But there was just this sense that we're all in it together.
Mm. But you were the one who had to sit there calmly a lot, kind of breaking really unbelievable, distressing
news. Well,
that's
it. Yeah.
Does it get to you at all ever?
It does, but not when you're doing it. I mean, you know yourself, there's a sense of you go on automatic pilot when you see that red light coming on. It's when you're outside the room, outside the studio that you know, we do our, oh my God, did you see this? Did you do that? You know, whatever. When you're outside.
But
when you go in, you kind of...
You switch off, Eileen, when you go in there. Yeah. What were the other big moments down the years that you remember now and think, God, that was big?
I think, I always say the story probably that impacted me the most was Dunblane, the massacre in Dunblane, where the guy went into the school and shot all the kids because I had just become a mother myself. And so that story, it was 6 months after Cormac was born in February 1996. That impacted me a way that I hadn't been impacted, same even by Ethiopia, which was a few years earlier and stuff like that. Because, and Andy Murray, the tennis player, was one of the kids in the school that day in Dunblane.
Yeah.
So that, on that level. But then for me personally, as progressing, I always talk about the coverage of leading up to the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
Because I was involved in those, what Ed Mulhall used to call the rolling bulletin, where you literally went into studio with nothing and you built it as you went. And I wouldn't have been that used to doing that live kind of interview situation. And David Davenport was in Belfast and I think I had Gareth Fitzgerald in the studio with me. And I remember, you know, when you start, you go in with your three questions and you're going to ask those three questions and you're not even hearing the answers. But I remember picking up something that one or other of them said and developing it and throwing it, you know, and I just remember like a light bulb moment where I thought I can think and speak at the same time.
But you'd never done that before as
a
newsreader.
It would be very much like the standard interview with the correspondent, which is 90 seconds or 2 minutes long and you've discussed it beforehand. You know, I was used to doing that, but this kind of rolling where you're actually guiding and leading the conversation. And I remember doing the live coverage and I was also on the 6-1 and there was stuff in Bosnia at the same time. So we came off the live broadcast and suddenly they said, OK, Paul Cunningham's coming up for a pre-record in 2 minutes. So I suddenly had to switch my head. OK, what the hell is happening in Bosnia today?
Yeah.
You know, so there was all that kind of stuff going on. And I remember driving down to Athlone on my way west to the Aran Islands. My sister was living in Athlone at the time on Friday, the 10th of April. And when the news broke of the Good Friday Agreement and Cormac was in the car and he was asleep. He was only 3 at the time. And we were going down to join Mat Dara in the West. And I knew if I went into my sister's house, she'd be watching Liverpool playing whoever they were playing on the Good Friday night. So I pulled in on the side of the road to listen to the coverage, to listen to the speeches of Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern coming out of Storm of Buildings. And that was a wow moment.
Yeah, that was so obviously you're dealing with a lot of history down the years, but that was the moment you thought this is history, this is real history. Yeah, tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
My background: I was born in Clontarf. My parents are from Laois and Westmeath, respectively. Daddy was Mick Dunn, RTÉ's first GA correspondent, having come from the Irish Press. So we grew up in a there's Lily and Mick and three daughters basically, but we grew up in a GA house and, you know, we'd be firm followers to this day. So we were brought to matches and everything as young ones. We went all around the country with mum and dad. I went to school in Belgrove and then Manor House in Raheny and then UCD. And when I left UCD, I went to France for a year, teaching in a lycée, giving English conversation classes. And while I was over there, the ad went into the paper. There was a big strike here in 1979, the postal strike. So my father contacted me and said, there's an ad for radio announcers. I think you should apply. Because I'd done a bit of debating and singing and, you know, public speaking and stuff like that in school, in school and college. And so he said, I'll send you over an application form, but in case it doesn't get here on time, I'll do one for you. And I reckon that got me the interview.
Oh, okay.
Because every fesh, every medal, everything I had was on that form.
Nothing like a proud father to write a CV, yeah. So you hadn't kind of any plan to end up in broadcasting?
No, I was always going to be a teacher. Ask my sisters, they'll tell you. Yeah. I was always the teacher when we played school at home, you know.
Yeah. So then, obviously you'd have had a very different life if you became a teacher. Mm. When you become a newsreader, and as you say, it's that you're in people's lives every day and everything. Does that allow you then to have a kind of a proper private life, or is it always kind of there with you when you're around
it
in the
is,
world?
It is, but I suppose because, not when I'm around the world. When I grew up with it though, you see, with Daddy.
Yeah.
So I was used to it.
Yeah.
I would be conscious of it, I suppose, when I'm out and about and stuff like that. And I always make the distinction between Dublin and the rest of the country too, because in Dublin, it's no great shakes to see Anne Doyle or Pat Kenny walking down Grafton Street. But if you land down the country, is it her? And if it is, what's she doing here? And we need to find out, you know.
Yeah.
But 99.9% of the time, it's lovely. People just want to say hello.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And it's
what about the 0.1%?
Well, usually if you're with a girlfriend. It doesn't happen as much anymore now that I'm in my 60s, but it used to. If I was in a pub, say, with a girlfriend, some yoke might land over and want to buy you a drink. And if you say no, they'll be insulted. But if you say yes, that buys them half an hour.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So yeah. That's the only time, really, you know.
Say no more. Yeah. Lots of very warm texts, Eileen, wishing Eileen every health and happiness, a steady, constant, trustworthy figure in all our lives. Remember during COVID time, being glued to the nightly news, filled with anxiety, Eileen and her colleagues became part of a routine that kept us informed and calm. And like someone else saying, Eileen's reassuring voice, you know. Someone else says, you're the true personification of a lady, and we will miss her,
nice.
Ken and Cork. But I suppose there is that aspect of the calm was always the thing. And then the thing about trust is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because our time's changing a bit in terms of, you know, like I grew up, there was the news, you know, Charles Mitchell or Morris O'Doherty, these were like paragons of, you know, they were giving it to you as it was, and anything you heard from them was right. And there weren't that many other sources. But now, of course, news has become a much more kind of relative term, if you will.
Mm. And even, well, the whole tenor of it is changing. Like they talk about news programmes. I've never presented a news programme, I will tell you. It's always been a news bulletin. And you see it particularly, say, on CNN and places like that, like it's Anderson Cooper's 360, or it's the Jake Tapper Show, you know.
Yeah.
Where the presenter is becoming the story. And that's anathema to me. And even I'm involved with the Kennedy Summer School, and we had a panel discussion this summer with a bunch of younger journalists, and they were all not broadcast now, but paper journalists. But they were talking about the pressure on them to tweet and to have opinions and stuff. Now, that's anathema to everything that I grew up with. You should not know how I feel about the news that I'm reading.
Yeah.
You make up your own mind. I'm just the messenger. You know, it's not about me. It's about you.
Yeah. Yeah. We probably are moving into a new era. Like a lot of kids now are getting their news in bites from TikTok, basically.
But what happens to those young journalists? So it's all very well now, and they comment on this, that and the other. The government swings in 2 years' time. Where's their credibility then?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now on the other side of it is I now have to get used to, even when I was talking to Keith Duggar the other day, giving an opinion, because I would just stay away, you know.
Yeah.
I would never have gone to a protest like today's protest on housing now when I was working here.
Yeah,
that might change.
It's a bit like being a judge or something. So is it that you have to keep a certain level of in your whole life?
In your whole life. And that's part of, I think, the trust that the people could see I wasn't coming with an agenda.
Yeah. And would you feel as well then that you wouldn't have hung around political circles and that kind of thing, that you had to keep your distance from all that?
Well, to a certain extent. But then, I mean, you know people, because this country is small.
Yeah.
And, for example, Enda Kenny's wife is from Clontarf, and we were in college together. So I would see her the odd time we were in Castlebar. But again, you know, the political thing, I remember one night there was a bunch for Michael Murphy's book launch. They can't go out in Castlebar. They couldn't. They can now, of course, that he's retired too. But I remember we formed a cordon around Enda and Fionnuala, and this was probably even before he became Taoiseach, was to let him relax and sit and have a drink in peace.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So I suppose, yeah, people need to be allowed to be human as well, don't they? Yeah. So I'm excited about this idea of Eileen Unleashed now. So are you going to start? Are you going to start writing opinion columns and telling us your views on everything?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. What will you do?
Not a lot. It's certainly in the near future. You know, I mean, I've been. That's what I keep saying. No more deadlines. No more. Sorry, I can't. I'm working. You know, I've got a couple of nice concerts coming up in the next month. I've one in Christchurch next Sunday night for the Cancer Society, in memory of a dear friend of ours, actually Martin Elliott, a Swiss journalist who worked here. He would have been on this program back in the day. And he died last year, and his wife is putting together this lovely concert in aid of the Cancer Society. I've one the following week in Ballina, a church fundraiser. So all seasonal, Christmassy, so that'll be all gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm looking forward to that. Our book, All Star Gazing, is still in print.
Yes, so this is, you and your sister wrote this. God, your father would have been proud.
Well, I hope so, yeah. We did it for him, yeah.
And this is talking to various All-Stars from down
so
the years.
Yeah, so Dad was one of the founders of it. And with three other journalists, Paddy Downey, John D. Hickey and Pádraig Páirceáin. And again, looking at the difference in the relationships, the reason they did it, they set up the scheme, was to pay back, give back to the footballers and hurlers who had given them so much enjoyment over the years. And so Daddy was also the first secretary of the scheme for 25 years. And anyone who knew him would know how meticulous he is. All his records are gone into the GA Museum. He kept everything.
Really?
Everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But they probably didn't see, because they were in a box underneath a shelf, the All-Star stuff. And Myra, my sister, discovered 25 files for the 25 years that Daddy was secretary of the scheme. And we knew the 50th anniversary was coming up, and we said, what are we going to do with all of this? And a friend of Myra said, why don't you two do something with it? So we approached the GA, and I think they liked the idea of the daughters and all the rest of it. So they gave us their backing, and PwC then came on board as well. And we built on Daddy's stuff, and we went around the country then and interviewed over 100 All-Stars. Now, COVID got in our way, so we were delayed by a year, and then we couldn't. We did have a launch. Thanks to PwC, we had a virtual launch in Croke Park and a small in-person launch, but not the big grand. We were going to tour the country. So we sold out our first print, and it's reprinted now. It's available online. And so we'll be pushing that a bit again coming up to Christmas.
Yeah. Listen, you don't sound like somebody who's going to go off and start doing the gardening or anything. There's a great energy off you. I'd say there'll be a few more projects, will there?
Yeah, there will. But nice things. You know, as I say, no more deadlines. Yeah. I never want to work full time again.
Yeah. And is MacDara approaching retirement as well?
Well, he's an actor, you see, so they don't have to retire.
He'll be retired at some stage rather than retiring.
He's still working on Ross na Rún, so he's up and down to Galway all the time, yeah.
Okay, listen, the warm texts keep coming, Eileen. Lovely to listen to Eileen today. She's my favourite newsreader, with her beautiful, clear voice and perfect diction, delivering the news in her calm way. I'll really miss her on her telly. That's from Aideen in Stillorgan. Brendan, in January or February 1982, when the snow was deep on the ground and nobody was going anywhere, I was feeding my baby late at night. I heard Eileen reading the news on the radio. I wondered how she got into the studio with nothing moving. I think I heard that she walked into Donnybrook from Clontarf.
That's right, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Okay, and look, lots of people wishing you every health and happiness and as I say, a wall of warmth there for you. You were a huge presence in people's lives, and I think people hope that you're not gone out of their lives quite yet. Eileen Dunn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan.